Hello, everyone. Welcome to Women's Sports Central. It is the end of the year. Today is Friday, December 30th, 2011. I'm Brenda Van Lingen, along with Michelle Vopel. You have any big New Year's Eve plans or any way to, you know, start off the new year?
Well, I'm going to go to Walmart tomorrow afternoon and get some dog food. So that'll be my big New Year's Eve plan. No, I'm just kidding. Yeah, I'm going to be hanging out with some friends on New Year's Eve and doing all kinds of geeky stuff, like watching old movies.
Nice.
So, and it's interesting because today, when we're recording this, is December 30th, and I know where I was a year ago today. I was fidgeting all afternoon waiting for the Stanford-UConn game to start in Stanford, California. I was out there. I believe I got to that game earlier than any game I've gotten to in my life. I think I was there 3.5 hours before tip-off. So, and I didn't want to have to worry about a place to park. So, I got there very early. And that game, of course, ended up being the end of UConn's streak and maybe a good start for us today to talk about the past year in women's sports.
Yeah, let's do that. Let's make this a good part of the show, just to look back at the year 2011, and the streak ended before the year started, and maybe it was setting up things to come. The fact that a lot of people were still talking about UConn and Stanford and Baylor possibly winning a national championship. And then it ends up that we have Texas A&M and Notre Dame in the final, with A&M winning their first championship. It was significant for women's basketball.
We had a lot of really interesting stories, I thought, in last year's NCAA tournament. And with all due respect to UConn, I think that was good for women's basketball. Courtney Vandersloot made it to the Elite Eight out at Gonzaga, and that was a really nice story. She performed so well individually and really, you know, helped her draft stock, because she got a lot of attention then, and well-deserved. It was something that she... I was glad to see her get that at that point in her career. And we had that great regional final between Baylor and Texas A&M, even though, of course, the green and
Baylor
gold people didn't.
So.
Yeah, they did not want to have that game played in the regional final level. But it ended up being such a amazing atmosphere in Dallas. That game just felt like a carnival beforehand. I mean, there was so much excitement and so many people who had unlike some regionals where there's people there but maybe not a lot of passionate fans. I mean, this was right in the heart of Texas, so you had a lot of Baylor fans, a lot of A&M fans, so it was a great game. And then on to the Final Four, and the Huskies make it again. And I was thinking about this before. I mentioned this to you, Brenda, that I can't think of a way to say this that is not going to irritate UConn fans, but as great as that program is and they deserve everything they've gotten, it was probably for the best of women's basketball that they didn't win the national championship last year. Dynasties bring a lot of attention, and that can be a really good thing. They set a standard. They make then for great upsets. Like, it's no fun to upset a team that doesn't win a lot. You know, that's what makes everybody excited, is if the team never, never, never loses and then they get upset. So UConn gets to play that role, you know, to be the team that everybody wants to beat. But it really probably was for the best to have Notre Dame, which had been there once before, a decade earlier, and then A&M had never been there, play for that national championship.
Mm-hmm. And I think you make some really good points. And the fact that Notre Dame beat UConn, just as Texas A&M beat Baylor, you know, conference foes that had been dominated by their opponent, but then the fact that it was Notre Dame and A&M that made it to the finals. But I want to give a tribute or a shout out to Gary Blair, just as we look back on 2011, because you talk about somebody that's paid their dues. You know, he started as a high school coach at South Oak Cliff High School in Dallas, Texas. And you know, it would have been fun to go back and see some of those teams play, because they won 3 state championships in the late 70s and got the attention of La Tech, Sonja Hoag hired him to be an assistant, and he worked with Leon Barmore at La Tech before building his own program at Stephen F. Austin. Everybody knew who Stephen F. Austin was in the 1980s because they were constantly a presence in the Sweet 16 and in the top 25. He moves on to Arkansas, takes Arkansas to the Final Four as the lowest seed to ever make it to a Final Four, and then comes to A&M, a team that had not experienced much success, was at the bottom of the Big 12, helped build them up over time to help A&M to, you know, get that upset over Baylor after losing three times during the regular season and winning against Baylor and then knocking off Stanford and then Notre Dame for the first national championship for Texas A&M.
I remember looking back because Gary Blair's son and his daughter and his wife were all sitting really close to behind where I was at press row. And looking back with about a minute left in the championship game, and his wife, usually she keeps a pretty good poker face, but his son was just, he like had his head down on the rail. You could tell he was like saying, please, please, please go clock, because he was, you know, I don't think they could have, you know, it's almost like it would have been unbearable to them to see their dad get this close and not win, because they know how much he's put into the sport. And that's something I always remember, is just looking back, because you know how for the family, you know, they've been through this journey just like, you know, the coaches or players have. They've gone through it, and they feel it and experience it the same way. And it was just, it was really kind of a cool moment to look back at that and then just see how relieved his son looked when the game was finally over and how proud he was of his dad, and getting a chance to talk to him in the locker room afterward. He was just glowing. I mean, I almost feel like Gary's family was every bit as happy about this as he was. So that was a neat moment. On the other side, which is an unfortunate thing, and it's too bad we think of this because it's not a failure, but Stanford made its fourth Final Four in a row and didn't win a championship. And that says a lot about how great and consistent that program has been. It's their 10th Final Four, but they haven't won a national championship now, and it'll be 20 years. So it's 1992. So that it's interesting because later this year, Tara Vanderveer was inducted into the Naismith Hall of Fame and very well deserved, has done so much in the sport. But you know, that's kind of just eating away just a little bit at her, that it's been that long since Stanford or the West Coast has won a national championship in basketball. Mm-hmm.
And before we leave and start talking about the other sports throughout the year, I also just want to mention Danielle Adams, because I think she's one of those players that is really an unsung hero in many ways, or underappreciated hero maybe, in that a lot of people didn't give Texas A&M much hope because they didn't know if Danielle Adams could help carry a team to a national championship. And she proved obviously that she can. And, you know, then going on and playing so well in the WNBA before injuring her foot, I think showed what an amazing basketball player she is. And when you take a look at her career, she was first signed by Missouri and then was academically ineligible and went the junior college route, but was the junior college player of the year, comes to A&M, was the most outstanding player of the Big 12 tournament championship her junior year. And then even though Brittany Griner got the best of her in the Baylor matchups, she came through when it counted the most in the national championship to help lead A&M to their first ever. And so, you know, she's one of those people that hadn't gotten a lot of attention nationwide necessarily because it was all about Brittany Griner and Maya Moore, et cetera. And Danielle Adams really carried her team on her shoulders, along with some great play from a lot of other players, but she was the star. And so, you know, I definitely want to recognize her as we talk about this as well.
Yeah, if you would have said at the beginning of the 2010-2011 season, okay, what are the odds of who's going to be the Final Four's most outstanding player?
Yeah, right.
I think she would have had a very, very tiny percentage, if anybody. I don't know anybody would have predicted her to do that. So it really was one of those great stories. And why sports is so great is you don't always know. You think you know what's going to happen, but you don't. And it still gets decided. It doesn't matter what any of us think or predict. It still gets decided by the people out on the court. And you're exactly right. When it counted most, Danielle Adams was the best player.
Yeah.
especially that championship game. I mean, especially it really is. That's really going to be one of those that everybody who watches women's basketball should remember, just how good she was and reliable she was in that game.
She was. She exerted her dominance inside. She hit the outside shots. Yes, Tyra White hit the biggest shot of the game at the end with about a minute to go, but it was because Danielle Adams had put them in that position. All right, let's go on. We have a lot of other sports to talk about from 2011 and just kind of tick through some of these. But softball was won by Arizona State. They won the national title beating Florida. Noteworthy in that was that Dallas Escobedo went 37-3 on the year. She was only a freshman, and she was the first freshman in the pitching circle to lead a team to a national championship since 1990. So a pretty significant accomplishment. And of course, Arizona State always good, but they will be plenty good with her the upcoming years. But then let's talk a little professional tennis and golf. And it was really the year of the Asian influence.
Yeah, and that's not anything particularly new. Well, it isn't new at all in golf, but a little bit, definitely more so in tennis. And, you know, in both cases, I would say if you're looking for an overall, the biggest story of the year, both in women's professional tennis and in women's professional golf, it would be Yanni winning a major. She won the French Open, which we'll have to see what kind of impact that has on tennis in China. You have the most populated country in the world, and seeing somebody from their country, she was in the Australian Open final and then won the French Open final. I would imagine there were quite literally thousands of little girls being signed up for tennis lessons. Probably the next day in China. So we'll have to see how that impacts the women's tennis tour over the next however many years, because we know what impact Sayri Park had when she won for South Korea back in 1998 when she won two majors. That changed the whole face of women's golf. And speaking of women's golf, Yanni Tsang, who is from Chinese Taipei, won two more majors this year and was Player of the Year. And the other kind of fun thing about her is she actually now lives in Annika Sorenstam's old house. Annika has taken a role as a mentor for her, which I think is a great thing. Annika's recognized just how good Yanni Tsang is, and turned out Yanni needed a new residence, and Annika had one for sale, and so she lives in Annika's old house. But Yanni Tsang, I saw as a junior player here in Kansas City quite a long time ago, win a tournament. And you never know, you know, when you see him that young, you know, 13, 14 years old, will you ever see him again? Or, you know, will they end up being a pro? Or in her case, will they end up being a superstar? And she ended up being a superstar. And she's still got so many more years of being a dominant player on the tour.
As we go through the rest of the calendar year, of course, the Women's World Cup, where the United States was just seconds away from their earliest elimination in Women's World Cup history with the dramatic comeback and Abby Wambach's header, and then the wins to take them to the finals, and then the heartbreaking loss in penalty kicks to Japan in the finals, but a memorable part of this past year as well in Women's World Cup soccer.
And that's another, you know, we talk about how you don't always see the impact of something immediately, but most of the time you can trace it back. And we talked earlier this year on the show about the expansion of women's soccer, women's college soccer, how you have more teams now. You know, North Carolina so dominated the sport for so many years. And look back to what age today's college players were in 1999.
Exactly.
They were 8, 9, 10-year-olds.
They were all of the kids with their faces painted.
Exactly. They were the pigtailed hooligans. And then when they entered high school and college soccer, they dispersed. And we saw the result of that the last few years with how much stronger that sport has gotten parity-wise. And I think you're going to look at the same thing globally with Japan winning, with other teams playing much better this year in the Women's World Cup. It's not, you know, something that's going to automatically be United States or you know, Norway, you know, or one of these, it ends up being a different champion. Brazil is still the heartbreak kid in international women's soccer. And you do feel I do feel bad for them because they just keep knocking on the door, both in the Olympics and the Women's World Cup. So we'll have to see, you know, what they bring into next year's Olympics. Mm-hmm. But I really think this year's Women's World Cup has, you know, we may be talking about it in 5 or 10 years as having a bigger impact than anybody even knew, you know, at the time.
And as we turn the page in the calendar, that was in July. And, of course, in August, the shocking news when Pat Summitt revealed that she has dementia, early onset Alzheimer's type, and just everybody rallying everybody in the women's basketball world, but really with such courage, being able to bring that to the forefront and to continue on with what she does better than anybody else. And she will be recognized one of the greatest coaches in any sport of all time. But now to, she already was so good at having all of her assistants do what they did to contribute. But now as they rally around her during this time, you know, you're seeing that on the sideline and just a different, dynamic and how she's continuing on. But you just wonder how many years she will continue to be on the sideline, because she has defined so much of this sport for so many years, and how long we'll have the opportunity, and how, you know, grateful we can be that she's shared with us what her situation is, so we can truly treasure whatever time that we have left in watching Pat Summitt on the sideline.
It was nice to see this week the greatest Tennessee women's basketball player, and I realize there may be some debate about that when you take post-collegiate success in and you bring Tamika Catchings in, but certainly for the time that anybody spent at Tennessee, it's Shamequa Holtzclaw winning 3 national championships and making an Elite Eight and being the all-time leading scorer and rebounder at that school. She was, I don't think it should ever, ever be forgotten that Shamequa Holtzclaw has had just an unbelievable college career. And it was nice to see her come back and be part of this effort to really put down as many memories as possible with former players. They all got together in Knoxville this week when Tennessee played Old Dominion, and there was some video on YouTube of that, of, you know, their gathering with Coach Summitt, and just to see how much she's meant to these people, to these, you know, former players, not just for what she did for them basketball wise, but what she did for them as far as what kind of people they are and how she helped them grow. And it was so heartfelt to see all of them, but especially, you know, I thought it was touching to see Shamequa talk about that.
And when we saw Shamequa at the WEPAC game in October in southwestern Kansas, she said that she had reached out to Pat, and, you know, in true Pat Summitt fashion, she wanted to know how Shamequa was. And Shamequa said, I called to comfort and give, you know, my strength to her, and, you know, in turn she was reaching out to me to lift me up. And so I'm not surprised that Shamequa was back, and so many players for the Lady Vols to thank Pat and to support her during this time.
Yeah, and, you know, I have to tell you, you know, I've gotten some emails, several actually, from people who are they're having a little bit of problem with this, because they can tell that Pat's not exactly the same on the sidelines, and she isn't, and she's been very open about that, and her assistants have been. And my feeling about that is, let's trust that these folks are going to make the best decision. Pat is not going to do anything to hurt her program, neither the people around her. And I think right now, even if she's in a different capacity, which she is, than she has been in the past, she is still Pat Summitt. She is still contributing to that program, and that program is contributing to her being able to fight this disease as much as it can be fought. It is a monster, and nobody knows how to beat it. Nobody's been able to. And you just hope that in some way what she's doing, being as brave as she is, being as open as she is, that's going to help lead to a cure. And yes. And a lot of the people, this might sound trite, but it isn't. It's as true as anything could be. This could be her greatest contribution as a human being. You know, we think of Pat Summitt, the, you know, one of the all-time greatest coaches in any sport of all time. her final, you know, legacy could be what she does to help, you know, contribute to a cure for this disease and other neurological diseases. So, I mean, that's a just an unbelievable impact that she's making.
Yeah, the awareness that she is raising about this and the dollars that are being raised. Yes, and you know it will continue. So I appreciate you saying that because I think that is absolutely the truth. Let's keep moving on and talk about, as we went into September and October, the WNBA playoffs, and Minnesota, a team that had not been to the playoffs even since 2004, came through and won a WNBA championship behind Simone Augustus and Maya Moore and Lindsay Whalen and that group, and bringing a first WNBA championship to a city and a state that much beleaguered in sports overall, but a tremendous accomplishment for the Minnesota Lynx.
Boy, you're not kidding. I mean, Minnesota really needed that, and it was so nice to see because of the people involved. It's like, well, Maya Moore couldn't win another national championship, although she did everything she could in that semifinal, but boy, you knew she wasn't going to be denied a WNBA. She was like, okay, I didn't win this one, so doggone it, I'm going to be a WNBA champion. So it was nice to see also how much she deferred to people, and she, you know, she was a part of that team. She really understood how she could impact that team as a rookie. Lindsay Whalen, another person really, you know, you thought really deserves a championship. Always nice to see Taj McWilliams-Franklin making us realize that a few people are ageless. And so it was overall an interesting season. You know, a bittersweet season for Tamika Catchings because she won the WNBA MVP award for the first time, but then got injured again during the playoffs. And you know, that was tough for her, getting injured in the Eastern Conference Finals. Atlanta Dream, now 2 years in a row going to the finals and getting swept. So the Dream's going to, I think, probably have to come back with even a little more vengeance. And this is going to be a tough year, 2012, because of the Olympics and how that's going to affect everything because of the break. So it was an interesting season. And you know, the thing is, I think all along we kept saying, oh, you know, it's kind of wide open. But the little voice in the back of our heads was saying, are we shortchanging Minnesota, maybe? Because is it really that wide open? Aren't they kind of dominating the way that Seattle did the year before? And it turned out, you know, they were a very similar team. Great locker room chemistry, a great player stepping forward, and just, you know, really, really playing well when they needed to play well.
And injuries are always a part of sport, but Minnesota's emergence coincided with Candace Parker and Lauren Jackson both being injured for LA and Seattle respectively. And so you always wonder how, if the balance would have shifted as much as it did had there not been those injuries, but it's part of sport, and Minnesota had all the pieces put together to win this championship. All right, let's continue moving on. October was a time where you and I spent a lot of time at media days and looking forward to the new basketball season. And of course, in November, we got the tragic news about Kurt Butke and Miranda Serna and their plane crash on the night of Thursday, November 17th. And, you know, I think just there's still a lot of people that are just really shaken up about that. And so many that are concerned about their team and so forth, because there have been other coaches that have passed away. And, you know, Maggie Dixon's death was tragic and just a young, bright star. But the season was over and it was just different timing when all of that happened. And, of course, Kay Yao and how she battled valiantly against cancer. And so there was the anticipation when she died. But the tragic nature of this plane crash, and the fact that Oklahoma State had experienced a plane crash before, and the fact that the Cowgirls, and you said it on this show, are a very young team this year, no seniors on the team, and Kurt Butke was so much looking forward to the future with this team, and they'd already played a game, they were into their season, so just all of those factors combined, I think, just still have so many, you know, shaken up about this, and so many are still holding the, you know, Jim Littell and his staff and all of the players in their hearts during this season.
Oh, absolutely. you know, I certainly thought about it on Thanksgiving. I thought about it on Christmas Eve. I thought about it on Christmas. I thought what it's like for Kurt's family and for Miranda's family to be going through this. And you know, it's just, it still doesn't seem real. Like, I still think I'm going to see him at the, you know, the next time that I see Oklahoma State. And, like, I have to keep reminding myself. Like, I literally, a couple weeks ago, it was like, it just hit me like, you know, like in a shocking fashion. I was like, oh wait, Kurt's not going to be there, you know? And so it really is, it's very jarring, I think, to both of us still. Mm-hmm. But the thing is, you know, I remember Morgan Medlock for Baylor, her mother was murdered, during the season, and she got that news by phone. And she said that playing basketball actually was the best therapy for her. What she dreaded was the season being over and having to really think about it. So, you know, I think with these, now that's obviously a different kind of personal loss and as profound a one as you can have. But I think Kurt was a father figure to all these kids. And so right now might be, you know, basketball sort of does almost work as a distraction. It may be that the springtime, you know, maybe a tougher time for all these kids, and obviously not just Kurt, but Miranda, because she was so close to all these kids. She was the one that recruited all of them and really a big sister figure. So it'll be interesting to see, you know, you talk about a team that everybody I know is, you know, deep down rooting for to achieve this season. It would be Oklahoma State.
They will start Big 12 play against Texas Tech this next week, and then in a couple.
How about
of weeks,
Texas Tech?
Yeah. We'll talk about 2012 and what's coming up right after we get through with our 2011. But I wanted to mention that when Oklahoma goes to Oklahoma State on January 14th, it's a Saturday. We'll be there. Fox will be there. I'll be on the broadcast, and Cindy Stein and I are going to go down a day before and spend the whole day with Jim Littell, with the staff, with the players, and just see how they're doing and just you know, be a part of what they go through on a day that's not a game day. Mm-hmm. And so we'll bring that to you on the broadcast on the 14th. But yeah, let's talk about Oklahoma State and Texas Tech but being undefeated, etc., when we look ahead, because conference play is going to start. Let's just go ahead and wrap up our look back at 2011. We've talked about on the show just recently that Stanford defeated Duke in the NCAA soccer title game, and then volleyball, Penn State's streak of four consecutive championship was ended, and UCLA finished off the year by winning the national title. So look back on the year that was.
Yeah, and I thought one thing I just thought was a kind of a cute story for UCLA is that Kelly Reeves, their sophomore hitter and the big personality on that team, was actually present the last time that UCLA had won a national championship was in 1991. And she was present because her mother was an assistant coach with the Bruins and had formerly played with the Bruins and was pregnant with Kelly. So she was there on the sidelines,
sort of,
which I thought was kind of cute. She was born the following April and then 20 years later wins a national championship of her own, which, you know, you know how we love these family connections,
exactly.
Brenda and mother-daughter and father-daughter stories. And I thought that was a really, really neat one from the volleyball Final Four.
That is fantastic. You always bring it. Nice job. All right, let's take a break, and then let's look ahead as the as conference play begins in women's hoops. Some good games to anticipate as we start the new year and the conference schedule. So we'll take a quick break and come back and discuss some women's hoops. Welcome back to Women's Sports Central, along with Michelle Vopel. I'm Brenda Van Lingen, and as the calendar turns to 2012 and the conference seasons start with the shakeup and of conference realignment that was this past year and continues to be, you know, conference play takes on a little different look, and some new rivalries will be established. Nebraska, of course, going to the Big Ten. They get things started off in the Big Ten in a very interesting way. They go to Penn State tonight on Friday. So nice welcome to the Big Ten, Huskers. that should be a tough game for the Huskers, but I'm looking forward to that game as Alex Bentley, the point guard for Penn State, one of the best in the country, and Lindsay Moore really establishing herself as one of the best point guards as well. Her stats are just amazing, and along with all the other subplots, I think that should be a really interesting game to introduce Nebraska to the Big Ten. And then, do you have anything to say about that?
Just, you know, it is interesting also when you look at the, you know, the other departure, if you will, departure from the Big 12, Colorado. They start their Pac-12 season against the other newcomer in the Pac-12, Utah. So that's kind of an interesting thing that they're starting in Colorado, undefeated so far.
Yeah.
So we'll have to see how good the Buffs really are.
Yeah, exactly. Linda Lappe, we talked about the fact that she was a good choice for that position. A lot of people doubted that she would be a good choice, but being so young and inexperienced, but as a former Buffalo that wants to come back and restore some tradition to the program. You know, they haven't played in an especially tough non-conference schedule, but they've gotten a winning attitude back, and that's been missing for a while. So I'm interested to see as well as Colorado goes forward in the Pac-12. In the Big 12, conference play starts next Wednesday, and so a few games I think that of note that we should mention. A&M goes to Kansas State, which of course is the last place that A&M lost last year in the regular season before they lost to Baylor in the Big 12 final and then went on their way to a national championship. So, you know, I'm sure Gary Blair has reminded his team of that just a few times as they go into Manhattan.
Yeah, and K-State hasn't lost a home this year. So they find ways to get things done you don't expect them to. I agree with you. I think the Aggies will be particularly primed, and they kind of need to. I mean, they haven't played as well as they would have liked to the last couple of weeks.
And that's where, obviously Baylor is by far the favorite. But it's right now the Big 12 is such in question as far as how good is everybody else that, you know, these first few games are going to be very interesting, very compelling. I think in the Big 12, Iowa State goes to Oklahoma. Oklahoma's been up and down. Iowa State struggled early. They've played better lately. But that, you know, now that's not just a one-time occurrence with the new 18-game round-robin schedule in Big 12 play. Iowa State and Oklahoma and all the teams that were north and south previously will go home and away. So that's one to keep an eye on. Kansas goes down to Texas. Kansas has had a good non-conference schedule, but really hasn't played anybody of note. So how good are they with Angel Goodrich and Carolyn Davis? And how will they match up against Cokie Reed and Chazity Fizel and everybody else with Texas? Oklahoma State, as we mentioned earlier, going to Texas Tech, both undefeated teams. And of course, then Missouri goes to Baylor. So after Missouri's done very well in their non-conference, you know, welcome to Big 12 play.
Yeah, that could be a pretty tough game for the Tigers. The Tigers traditionally have not played, and this goes way back to the start of the Big 12, and you could even go back to the Big 8. There are a few visits to Texas back then. The Lone Star State has not been a good place for Missouri to visit. In fact, for the longest time, they hadn't won a game there. It was I've forgotten. I remember it was at the Kansas City Star once figuring it out, and I had to figure it out four times to believe that it had been so long since Missouri had actually won a game anywhere in Texas. So that's a tough place to start, but it's also, you know, it's a good measuring stick for the Tigers because, like you said, they I believe they're 9-1. So let's see how good they are. Will they go down there and at least compete with Baylor? And the game that's really interesting because we don't know how good either one of these teams are either is Texas Tech and Oklahoma State. I think right now, Texas Tech is ranked. And, you know, they went to the NCAA tournament last year, and we know that they have some real talent. But I feel like of some of the top unbeaten teams, they strike me as being the one that I don't believe has been that tested so far. And so we'll have to see if Oklahoma State can be a test for them.
And it just makes me think back to I had the Oklahoma State at Texas Tech game on Fox Sports last year, and it just makes me think back, and so many of these, well, all of the Oklahoma State games will now, of talking to Kurt Butke before the game, and he knew that Texas Tech needed that win to get in the NCAA tournament, and you know, he actually almost hoped for Christie that Texas Tech would win. You know, he said that in a way like, you know, we're going to fight, we're going to play hard, but you know, Christie's worked very hard at Texas Tech, and they upset Baylor, and you know, they deserve to go to the NCAA tournament. I just remember having that conversation with him before that game, and it'll be interesting as Oklahoma State travels to all these places in the Big 12, how the fans and coaches and players will receive them as they go to each city.
I'm not surprised by that at all, because Kurt was a, like all coaches, very, very competitive guy, but also a guy who got the big picture. And that's one of the things I'll miss most about him, because he really did get the big picture, both of the Big 12 and women's basketball. You know, because you kind of have to. You have to have a pretty broad vision to say, yeah, we really want to win this, but yeah, you know, it's not. It's probably for the good of women's basketball to have Texas Tech back in the tournament, which it is. Mm-hmm. And I think there's not all coaches are like that, but he was.
Yeah, exactly. All right, let's look at a couple other as conference play starts in the ACC. Last night, Maryland defeated Delaware.
That was an exciting matchup.
Yes.
Because Delaware's got a lot of eyes on them now. Mm-hmm. I wonder why. Certain player. Yeah. EDD.
Yes. And she had 32 points, and Maryland could not contain her, but wasn't enough to be able to beat Maryland. So they are still undefeated.
Another one of the undefeated. So we're kind of waiting to see. But I like their non-conference schedule better. I mean, they have played some people. I like Ohio State's even better in terms of, you know, undefeateds. But yeah, Maryland, let's see. You know, they were sort of kind of on the way back last year, but not all the way there. So are they all the way there this year?
Well, and I think we'll find out very shortly, because as you look at their conference schedule, they will be going. They are at Florida State, then Georgia Tech, North Carolina, and Miami in succession. So we'll find out how good Maryland is, I think, probably within the next couple of weeks.
I will get a chance to see that, the game at North Carolina. Actually, I'm going to be going out to the East Coast next week, and that's one of the games I'm going to be able to see. So that'll be interesting, both from the Tar Heels perspective, or both from the Terrapins perspective, but also the Tar Heels, because after that shellacking by South Carolina, we'll see. Did that really wake up North Carolina? And they said, "Wait a minute, you know, we're a better team than this." Mm-hmm. And how good a team are they?
Well, and North Carolina will play Miami on New Year's Day, so that'll be an opportunity for them to bounce back. In the Big East, the biggest game as far as ranked teams going against each other in the next week is Georgetown and DePaul. And then in the SEC, Georgia and Tennessee will line it up next Wednesday. So a few good conference matchups to keep an eye on as we look at the first week of the year.
I'll see Georgetown and DePaul too. I don't get a chance to see that many Big East teams live. Just my travel doesn't generally work out that way. But as it turns out, I'm flying into DC on that day, and I made my trip specifically so I'd get a chance to see. You know, usually the only Big East teams I see a lot of times are UConn, Notre Dame, and mm-hmm. And so I haven't seen Georgetown in person in a few years, mm-hmm. and so I'll have a chance to see that game and just see how good those two teams are. Mm-hmm. And a chance to see Sugar Rogers in person, who I believe you've seen much more recently. So that'll be an interesting game. And then I'll close my trip out with seeing Maryland and North Carolina.
Yeah. And
will you be going to Kansas State? That's next weekend, not this coming weekend.
Yeah. Actually, I'm not. And here's the reason. My alma mater is honoring my senior class team. And so I'm going back and seeing my teammates and being a part of that celebration before I hit the road for Oklahoma and Texas A&M on Sunday's national game.
Do you now average 10 more points a game than you did back then?
Of course I do. Although they sent me a box score stat sheet from my senior year, and I was like, you know, actually better than I thought I remembered it being, so that was good.
That should be a lot of fun.
I'm looking forward to that, and a lot of my teammates are getting together, and it's just, you know, people that were such a big part of your life for, you know, a significant portion, and we haven't seen each other for a long time. So I appreciate Kevin Chaney, the coach at the University of Nebraska-Kearney, inviting us back and honoring our team, and it should be a lot of fun. But I will be keeping my eye on the score.
Kansas State. Yeah. That is always kind of a fun big game here. And a big deal to Kansas. I mean, you know, they have really gotten the short end of the stick in this series with K-State over the last decade. Mm-hmm. And especially... we had a run there several years where Kansas had a really good non-conference, you know, record, or pretty good, and then they would go play K-State and just get walloped. They did that 2 years in a row, and I think it really set a bad tone for them for the whole conference season. So Kansas, not to bring this up again, but I gotta, since it's been since 2000, they played the non-conference or got the non-conference record they needed. Now can they get enough conference victories to get back into the tournament for the first time in over a decade? And we're going to have to really watch how they start the season, because yep. I do think that makes a big difference with that team in terms of their whole mindset. If they get off to a good start, you know, even if they go to Texas and lose, but if they get off to an overall good start the first few weeks of conference season, that can make all the difference for them.
And they play that game against Kansas State in Lawrence, so that helps.
Definitely. They've really struggled in Manhattan for a while now.
But puts the pressure on. Well, we'll keep an eye on that. We'll be back here next Friday, as always, to talk about conference play as things start heating up in Big 12, Big East, SEC, ACC, all across the country, and Pac-12 as well. So we'll be back to talk about that next Friday. Thanks for joining us. Tell other people about the show here at womenssportscentral.com. On behalf of Michelle Vopel, I'm Brenda Van Lingen. Happy New Year, everyone.